I had some notion for a story about a cartoon mouse caught in a mouse trap drawn in a 1950s horror comic style, but it didn't pan out. I was blocked. I was totally stuck until I sat in on one of Ken Jacobs' film classes at Harper College. So, what's the difference between those anthropomorphic animals and these subhuman minstrels? This Jazz Age Mickey Mouse is just Al Jolson with big ears. Eureka! My strip for funny animals. Race in America. Cats with burning crosses. Lynched mice. Ku Klux Cats! Shit. I know bupkis about being black in America. Bupkis. But then Hitler's notion of Jews as vermin offered a metaphor closer to home. And that led to a three-page strip, the earliest thing in the Breakdowns collection, which started me off on what became a 13-year-long project a few years later, this first one in 1972. So I had to find a story worth telling, and I realized I had a lot of unfinished business with that three pages, that little slice of Mao's, made at a time where the Holocaust was barely a phrase in people's consciousness, where there wasn't like a whole genre of Holocaust literature. Just trying to wrestle out and figure out where I'd come from was interesting. And the notion of doing a long comic book that needed a bookmark, was an interesting formal challenge.
Welcome to a special episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser, and for the next half hour, you'll be hearing from Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the graphic novel Mouse. Art sat down for a conversation with Bill Dodge and me in October of 2008 here in Portland, and he also gave a lecture in February of 2006 in Eugene, Oregon, addressing the controversy at the time about Danish cartoons that depicted the Prophet Muhammad and the reluctance of American media outlets to cover the issue candidly. We'll be playing excerpts from both of those appearances. While you're enjoying these vintage interviews, we'd like to encourage you to take a moment, go online, and support community radio at kboo.fm. And now, Art Spiegelman, recorded at the studios of KBOO Radio, October 9th, 2008. Now let's mention another comic that's in your collection, Breakdowns. This comic about your mother's suicide, this one hit me just like a steamroller when I first saw it. And, well, confessional comics nowadays, they've been gaining a bad reputation because a few whiny artists are convinced that their romantic dramas or pornography obsessions or whatever are endlessly fascinating to the reading public. But, you know, decades ago, when you and Ewan Crumb and Aileen Kaminsky and all that crowd were laying out your deepest, darkest secrets on the page, the result was some truly fearless literature. This in particular, this 1970 comic Prisoner on the Hell Planet, packs more of an emotional punch in just a few pages.
Well, you know, it's one of those comics where I didn't even know if I would let it get published after I finished drawing it. It was just something I needed to make. It was like all of a sudden, the memories of the moments surrounding my mother's suicide, I had totally repressed. It happened in 1968. I just turned 20. I was just out of a nut house. And my refugee mom couldn't take it anymore. And if somebody asked me, where are your parents? I'd say, oh, my mother killed herself. But it never registered what I'd literally buried that memory from 4 years before. And when it came flooding back, I stopped the rather dopey strip I was working on and needed to make this thing. And that became a totally obsessed work. And although I usually think of comics as something one makes specifically for publication, this was something I just knew I needed to do.
So it was more art therapy for you.
It's not
first.
That exactly. I always flinch at that because therapy...
Well, I think it was therapy for your readers.
Well, the thing is that I got irritated at some kid who was not nearly as knowledgeable as you, who was interviewing me for a Miami magazine, and said, so do you think of your work as therapy? And I said, no, damn it. Like, look, therapy is like vomiting. Making art is like eating your own vomit. So in this particular thing, after I'd worked out like remembering what happened, I needed to just give it form, you know, to give my feelings form. And it involved making a new comics vocabulary for myself. I'd just become Punch drunk in love with the high arts after a few decades of being very suspicious of anything that wasn't appearing on newsprint. And so the drawings for Prisoner on the Hell Planet were very inspired by my new infatuation with German artists like George Grosz and Max Beckmann.
A lot of the Weimar era printmakers and pen and ink guys. Yeah.
Yeah, they were like, you know, sort of cousins working on the other side of the hyphen between high and low. Uh-huh. And that work was very potent for me, and it was useful for expressing the rawness of the emotions there, right? So it was, even the kind of storytelling, it's one of the earlier pieces in this collection, but it's the one that really was the breakthrough moment in the sense of finding a new vocabulary with which to make comic stories. And it was used in Mouse because I couldn't figure out any other way to tell my about my mother's suicide when I'd already portrayed it. And so it's inserted as four pages within the long version of my Mouse book.
So then on to Mouse, to give listeners an intro to it. It really did cause a sea change in comics in that previous to it winning a Pulitzer, usually if cartoonists won Pulitzer, it would be one or maybe two editorial cartoons, but not a graphic novel. So that it was proof that it was a medium for any kind of story.
When I got the Pulitzer, it was like I get a call and I'm told, congratulations, you just won a special Pulitzer. And I was sure it was a joke because I figured if it was a special Pulitzer, it would be like Special Olympics, you know, some odd category. So it wasn't like the editorial cartoons that are awarded every year. It was who got this thing? Dr. Seuss got one. Mm-hmm. And I think it was some musical comedy team, either Rogers and Hart or something like that, and a few other odd authors that didn't fit in any category.
Good company.
Where they still wanted to award it. So it was an interesting place to be because I always kind of, when I was going into bookstores looking for Mao's in the days before graphic novels existed as a section, I would find that it was never placed anywhere that made any sense to me. It was either placed with humor books or it would be placed with Judaica, which I guess is possible, but it didn't fit comfortably there. And so I was always hoping there'd be a sui generis section in a bookstore, but there never quite was. And my favorite thing that happened there was my local bookstore for years had Mao's on the new releases table. And I thought this was a great accolade. And I finally went and introduced myself to the store manager after a couple of years and said, you know, thank you. It's really great to be able to find this thing up with your new releases every time I come in. He says, yeah, I could never figure out where to put the damn thing.
Well, one thing about Mouse that makes it such a compelling read is that the main character is not entirely sympathetic, even though it's the story of your own father's struggle during the Holocaust. What I found really powerful about the book was the theme of human desperation, and not just how inventive do I have to be in this situation, but how seriously do I have to compromise my morals in order to survive the horror.
Okay.
In the end, your father never quite understood what you were trying to accomplish with the book, with Mouse.
Well, I mean, one of the things was I was not able or interested in making a work about the noble survivor. You know, like it wasn't about this notion that suffering ennobles, very Christian notion. All suffering does is cause pain. And I didn't want to present him without presenting him warts and all, nor myself as a character. I don't portray, as you just said, myself as some kind of long-suffering noble son. I'm kind of ungrateful and snappish as portrayed in the book. And that seems to me like trying to deal with the complexity of what a character is actually like. And one of the phrases that I ended up thinking about a lot while working on Mouse was, you know how like somebody could come up to you and say, you're not yourself today? And I was thinking, yeah, that's right, because what the heck is a self anyway? And what I realized was if I was making Vladek up as a fictionalized character, I would never have given him, say, the capacity to be so understanding when he stumbled across this comic strip I'd made about my mother's suicide. I thought he would have, if I had to make him up, I would think he would be annoyed and feel like I was letting out private skeletons into the world. And instead, he was saying, no, no, it's good you got it out from your system. And it's one of those many instances where Vladek is much more multidimensional than one would make a comic character.
There's another point about Mouse that I think is worth talking about, in that you were talking with Gary Groth a few years ago about your father's friends' reactions to it. And
part of the introduction to this new Breakdowns book is there's I should say a word perhaps about the introduction, which is it's very compressed memories juxtaposed not in a chronological order and interrupted by comics theory and memories about comics as well as memories that shaped and misshaped me. And one of the compressed memories is the anecdote you're just referring to where while working on that 3-page mouse strip, which was just a... meant to be in a comic book called Funny Aminals, in which the only requirement was something anthropomorphic. Robert Crumb had done the cover and a lead story about two little fox guys chasing this giant big-legged chicken woman, trying to seduce her, it seems, and luring her up to the apartment and then eating her. Not in a way that the FCC would get upset about hearing on the radio, but eating her because she's a chicken and they're foxes. So that was the kind of stories that people were doing in underground comics. And after a while, as explained in another bit of the introduction to Breakdowns, I'd come across this other thing, which was The Return of the Repressed, yet again, dealing with my parents' experiences in an anthropomorphic way. So that was the 3-page version of Mao's that I was working on and went back to show my father while I was working on that 3-page strip, but before I'd written it all, even I was already drawing parts of it. And then he's looking at it, and he's all of a sudden telling me, you know, that guy, that character that you're showing over there, I buried that man. I buried him. And so all of a sudden, the rest of the strip is being told to me by my father, this man who I could barely be in the same room with. And I realized I'm going to have to stay and get the rest of his story. And when I'm the same evening when I'm showing him this stuff and he tells me that his friends are around playing cards with him. That's what you were just asking me yes. about. And they spent the entire evening swapping their own stories because they were all survivors of one kind or another from either gulags or the death camps. And they get very interested in it. This is a generation and a culture of Eastern Europe that had no use or interest in comics, couldn't read them, basically. And the whole evening, there was never any mention that I'd used cats and mice instead of people in this strip. This odd strip I was making.
Well, that's funny. I mean, probably the biggest mainstream misconception about the comic scene is that it's just populated with funny animals or superheroes.
Well, as you said, that's shifted in the recent past.
Well, it has, but it's interesting that Mouse, this Pulitzer Prize winning book, started life as a funny animals idea, mm-hmm. and which by the way, wasn't totally without controversy. You caught some flack for making the Gentile Poles into pigs, for
example.
Well,
that's in the... I don't think there were any... Poles in the 3-page story, but certainly in the longer book that got me into some trouble. Like at a certain point, in fact, I tried to get a visa so I could go to Poland when it was still under the Iron Curtain. And the first book had come out, but I needed to go and look again at these areas so I could draw them for the second volume of Mouse. And word proceeded that I was going to do this with a film crew because they were going to film my visit to the death camps for German television. And that's what paid for the trip and got me over there. This must have been, 1988 or something, you know. And so they said, fine, but if you want a visa, you're going to have to come down and talk to the person at the consulate who came from Washington, D.C. to meet me. And he says, you know, it's a terrible calumny to call somebody a pig. In Polish especially, it's worse than you know. And you know, the Germans called us fine. And so then I responded saying, yeah, and, you know, I draw the Jews as mice, and we were considered vermin. And so the calumny isn't just from me. It's from the Nazis and the metaphors I pulled out of that situation. And he looked really relieved. But then I have a big mouth. So then I went on to say, you know, I would have drawn them as noble stags, but that's too hard to draw. And in any case, considering the relationship between Poles and Jews in the 20th century, non-kosher animal seemed appropriate. And that carried all of the complexity of the reasons that I chose that animal.
I'm S.W. Counsor, and you're listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures featuring Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the graphic novel Mouse. Bill Dodge and I spoke with Art while he was in Portland in October of 2008.
Our listeners will recall that there was a time just a couple of years ago when the world could not stop talking about cartoons. And this, of course, was the Danish cartoon kerfuffle when the right-wing newspaper Jyllands Posten asked a couple of dozen local cartoonists to submit depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. And soon after that, while these cartoonists were in hiding, you went on a lecture tour and did a very exhaustive study of comics history.
Well, the lecture came after the essay that I wrote for Harper's Magazine,
okay.
Actually. What it was I just became obsessed with this story because it was the biggest thing that happened connected to cartoons in my lifetime. And I thought that it was impossible that these things weren't being shown. They were just being talked about. And it was a story one could only get from the internet. And since it was Google was only one click away from the stuff I was coloring on my computer, I just get lost in the black hole of trying to find out more about what this whole story implied. And it led to the editor of Harper's asking me to write about it, since that's what was obsessing me. So maybe, I don't know what part I should read, but I'll start it at the beginning and you tell me one.
I'll just keep going.
It was called Drawing Blood, Outrageous Cartoons and the Art of Outrage. The tragedy of the Danish cartoon war that erupted in February, this is from 2006, is that it really wasn't about cartoons at all. Cartoons, even hateful ones, are symptoms of a disease, not the cause. Those Danish cartoons were what Alfred Hitchcock called a MacGuffin, the almost irrelevant plot device that just gets a story rolling. The cartoon insults were used as an excuse to add more very real injury to an already badly injured world, and in this at least, they succeeded. They polarized the West into viewing Muslims as the unassimilable other. For true believers, the insults were irrefutable proof of Muslim victimization and served as recruiting posters for the Holy War. I'm not a believer, but I do truly believe that these now infamous and banal Danish cartoons need actually to be seen to be understood. If, as the currency of cliché has it, a picture's worth a thousand words, it often takes a thousand more words to analyze and contextualize that picture. It wasn't a question of adding insult to an open wound like the far-right thugs of the British National Party did in February by distributing 500,000 leaflets of the emblematic hot-headed prophet to sow more xenophobic discord. It's a matter of demystifying the cartoons and maybe even robbing them of some of their venom. I believe that open discourse ultimately serves understanding and that repressing images gives them too much power. As a secular Jewish cartoonist living in New York City, I start out with four strikes against me, but I really don't want any irate Muslims declaring holy war on me, although I'm not at all religious. I am a devout coward. As a cartoonist, I hope to see cartoons and comics flourishing in the 21st century and have long urged librarians, scholars, curators, booksellers, editors, and readers to pay more attention to my chosen medium. I'd also like to see the 21st century flourish, and so I urge extremist Muslim clerics to take cartoons somewhat less seriously. And at that point, I got Harper's to print the cartoons that nobody was willing to publish at the time and gave them 1 to 4 fatwa bomb ratings from my own secular point of view as to how clear they were and what points they were making.
And a couple of these cartoonists were left-wingers who were making fun of newspaper.
You know, when the Times was saying, oh, they're banal and you don't have to look at them, that was totally missing what was actually going on, and that's sort of what started my indignation rolling.
You've been credited with the New York Times, for example, these days. For however many years they were publishing, they stayed away from comics. Now they've got a page in the Sunday New York Times magazine that's a comics page. And you've been credited with making it okay for that to happen. the American media establishment is still famously ignorant about the contemporary comics industry. And so you've become the number one guy on their speed dial. You know, whenever the cultural editor at Mega News Corp needs a quote about comics or an artist referral, as often as not, you know, the person will say, get me Art Spiegelman.
You know, from the place where I'm looking at it from, it seems like all of the things that I could only hallucinate about back in the period when I was working on the breakdown strips, for example, are now a reality. Like, many comics appear in legitimate magazines, so that Joe Sacco is sent to be embedded and does a long piece for Harper's Magazine. That's really, you know, would have been unheard of 10 years ago. The Times pages that you're talking about that were publishing Chris Ware and Dan Clowes and others. The notion of a comic for adults, even if it's traveling under this kind of clumsy phrase, graphic novels, has its own place in the bookstore, in college university curricula, in library shelves, in museum shows. This is like a new situation for comics that seems like a done deal. I don't think it can retrench fully back to the pejorative notions of, like, the guy's a moron, he reads comic books, you know? That'll never happen again. And it seems to me that while America has turned to total sludge, comics have been doing just fine. And basically, it's a situation that really allows for not only the kind of respectable comics that everybody can harump and go, ah, yes, it's a serious comic, it's about the Iranian Revolution, but it also allows for the stupider kind of comics to, like, flourish, because there's still now a context for comics to be part of the real conversation. You know, I have no bone with stupid comics. I just figured this was a Faustian deal that I tried to strike since the early 70s, which is finding a new place for comics to exist when it was no longer mass media seemed like an important thing to arrange, even if it meant that it there was the danger of it losing its edginess, and the kind of id monsters that are allowed to come through in comics are part of what makes them so amazing. But I figured this was an experiment worth making and a deal worth driving, because it would allow for, first of all, a wider range of what could be expressed in words and pictures together, to quote the title of your show, and also would allow room for comics to move in other deviant directions back to their pornographic roots if necessary.
Yeah, deviance and respectability. Well, you know, we've said this before on the show, but Japan and Europe have made both deviant and respectable comics for years, part of the mainstream of literature. But now that respectability is coming forth in American comics, there's some infighting in the industry, and I'm sure you've heard some of the younger cartoonists say, oh, Art Spiegelman's got all this power, and he only suggests assignments for his friends.
Yeah, which really also isn't true. You should know my relationship with some of the people I publish. I wouldn't call them all friends. No, it really is this kind of strange patricidal thing more than anything else. You know, it's like there's a certain point where in order to make your bones, you've got to kill the older generation off, you know? And I think that that's sort of something I've had to suffer through for the last few years, which is only karmically fair, considering my relationship with my father becoming a patriarch of comics was being stabbed in the eye by the younger cartoonists. It's not the only thing that's happening, but it's certainly part of the interactions that I've been involved in.
Sort of Greek tragedy, you know.
Well, or farce, but farce. I don't know.
I'm S.W. Konser, and you're listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures, featuring Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the graphic novel Mouse. Bill Dodge and I spoke with Art while he was in Portland in October of 2008. And now let's play a few minutes from a lecture Art gave in Eugene, Oregon, in February of 2006, about the failure of American media outlets to straightforwardly cover the Muhammad cartoon controversy.
I suspect that at least two-thirds or more of you have not seen these cartoons, you've read about them. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, this is nuts. So, here are the cartoons that can be found on the internet, but not in print easily, which to me is symptomatic of the death of the newspaper. The fact that the newspaper has decided to be like the porn filter on the internet for kids, to infantilize the readers so they don't understand what's being done in any precise way. It's insulting to me to think that, like, as the New York Times put it, these pictures, in order to be sensitive and respectful, needn't be shown. They're banal, and it's enough to describe them. And what made it super insulting was they then didn't go on to describe them. They just said they were banal, and they are to a degree. They look so normal, as you'll see when I show you a couple of these, that it's hard to understand the full impact of this as an insult, because there's a range of responses. There's 12 images and to a degree, maybe 12 different points of view on what started out as a contest of sorts, saying that this newspaper was saying, well, Europeans have become afraid to show Mohammed. It seems that a rather well-known children's book writer, who's caricatured in one of the 12 cartoons over here, was trying to do a respectful book on the life of Mohammed, and he couldn't find anybody to illustrate it because everybody was afraid. Incidentally, if the New York Times had just said, it's not a matter of respect, it's just that we're scared shitless, I really would have had a lot more respect for the New York Times position, because although I'm not devoutly religious, I am a devout coward, and that I would be able to kind of get my brain around. The proof that it wasn't a matter of respect was within a week there was an article by their art critic about insulting images with religious iconography, talking about these cartoons and also talking about Serrano's Piss Christ and talking about the Madonna done by Chris Ofili with elephant dung on it. And what do they choose as an illustration? One of the cartoons that's in the front of the news? No. They choose the dung Madonna because most Christians don't carry sabers or suicide belts, and therefore they weren't intimidated, and that was what it really was about. Anyway, sorry. Back to this thing. But what these cartoons are really about is the fearfulness of the West in dealing with it, and it left me feeling, you know, understanding the fear, but kind of ashamed of our press, because in Europe, At least 2 dozen or more major newspapers published these things in solidarity. Many of the papers were toward the right, toward the nationalist. On the other hand, not all of them, including a paper I've always loved as a transgressive cartoonist, started in the late 60s. It was like France's version of The Onion or something, called Charlie Hebdo, which just plows into every kind of taboo image it can and has from the get-go. So it was just, as soon as they heard about the cartoons, they knew they would publish them. So they published all of them. They published essays about it. They also published anti-clerical cartoons, anti-Semitic cartoons, cartoons in this issue, where the cover was Mohammed is overwhelmed by the fundamentalists. It's really hard to be loved by assholes. Now, each of the countries that objected to this, again, it's the most extreme elements, but the countries who had violent protests all had their own agendas, right? Like in Pakistan, it has to do with trying to get Musharraf out of power and have a Taliban government in Pakistan. In Syria, where the protests were encouraged, it had to do very specifically with the fact that Denmark had been prodding the United Nations to push harder on its human rights initiatives in Syria. So Syria was glad to have an excuse to kick back at the Danes. And in general, it was about giving a safety valve to the poor Muslim masses who never saw these damn cartoons but were told the prophet was insulted, and you can kind of have protests about that but not about how you're treated by your government. So it fomented this clash of civilizations. And in America, of course, the same thing. It had to do with other agendas than the cartoons themselves. Like Bush immediately said, very disrespectful, Americans shouldn't see this, it shouldn't be published. Why? Because this government has a vested interest in suppression of information and visuals. You can't even see a picture of f***ing Abramoff with Bush, you know, let alone the prophet. You can't, you're not supposed to see, you're not supposed to see pictures of coffins with flags draped over them. We're not seeing the pictures of Abu Ghraib unless you're looking on the internet that are on 24-hour cycles on Al Jazeera throughout the Middle East and seen regularly in Europe. Those are the real insults and the real outrages, and it's all part of the infantilizing of us that is our agenda in keeping these images suppressed. Now, meanwhile, while the insult was perceived as heinous, as you know, the Middle East is full of anti-Semitic imagery that goes back into medieval-type images. You may have heard that Iran has set up an anti-Semitic cartoon contest in response, because, by God, the Danes insulted them, so they're going to punish the Jews. The Danish editor said, fine, we'll print them, you know. That's about the time that he was yanked out of his job and told to go on leave, that this was too stressful a job. But he was fine with printing it's really important to understand through all the complexity what it means to be intimidated out of having a real dialogue that involves understanding what catalyzed this stuff and understanding even the spectrum of opinions that surround it. That somehow, as one Islamic cartoonist in Algeria put it, why should we have to follow Sharia law? They don't have to draw pictures of the prophet. They see this as disrespectful, and like I said, that's how it was intended. Nevertheless, they weren't all disrespectful images, and as soon as these enter a political arena, they're fair game. And what could be more political than blowing up embassies?
You've been listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in Portland in October of 2008 and in Eugene in February of 2006. I'm S.W. Counser, joined by Bill Dodge, and our guest was Art Spiegelman, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the graphic novel Mouse. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.fm. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @WordsAndPicture.